This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 28, 2018 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world. It may have occurred to others, but I've yet to read or hear of anyone making comparisons between what has been happening at our border with Mexico these days and with the even more deadly conflict at Israel's border with Gaza since the early spring. While there are clearly many differences, there is one similarity which should not escape our notice. Both the situation of the Palestinians under decades-long siege and blockade by Israel and Gaza, and that of the thousands fleeing to our border to escape the deadly violence in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, are arguably the results of the foreign policy and actions implemented by U.S. administrations over the last half century, regardless of which party controlled the White House and Congress. In Central America, it has been U.S. support for the corrupt and powerful, while in Gaza, it has been a longstanding policy of arming and backing the occupier while sanctioning the occupied, with not a single voice arising in Congress to challenge it. Gaza will be the subject about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Donald McIntyre, the former Jerusalem correspondent of the London Independent, whose recent history of the fabled strip along the Mediterranean, Gaza Preparing for Dawn, is by far the most comprehensive to date. Our discussion will come at a timely moment. Just 2 weeks ago, a bungled Israeli intelligence operation and an exchange of fire between Hamas and the Israeli military that followed came very close to initiating another one-sided attack by one of the world's most powerful armies and air forces against an imprisoned people that have neither or nothing beyond the ability of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, to launch a barrage of hand-fashioned low-power rockets. They are scary for those on the receiving end, but almost have to score a direct hit to cause any damage. As I reported on my last program, Egypt, the UN, Norway, and Switzerland helped achieve a ceasefire which led to the resignation of Israel's defense minister Avigdor Lieberman, who was eager for another slaughter. A threat by the ultra-right-wing Jewish Home Party to pull out of the government and force new elections if its head, Naftali Bennett, was not appointed in Lieberman's place failed to materialize when Netanyahu refused and took over the defense portfolio himself. Thus far, the ceasefire is holding. What is also holding, and which you probably haven't heard about, is the hold Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has put on U.S. military aid to Israel. Paul, who has previously called to cut the arms gifts of U.S. taxpayers to Israel, recently put a hold on the U.S.-Israel Security Alliance Authorization Act of 2018, which codifies into law the $38 billion arms package for Israel over 10 years that was negotiated in the final days of the Obama administration. A hold is a parliamentary procedure that allows senators to prevent a motion from reaching a floor vote. The Senate passed the act in early August, which you probably didn't hear about, and the House followed suit the following month. Before it goes to the White House, however, the Senate must pass a final version in line with the bill passed by the House. In order to bring pressure on Paul to change his mind, Israel's domestic lobby, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, has recently brought advertisements on Facebook identifying Paul as the main force blocking the act. At the same time, Christians United for Israel, Kufi, sent out an action alert email blast on Monday to its supporters, calling on them to flood Paul's office with calls and letters encouraging him to support the legislation. Kufi has also reportedly invested heavily in ads in Kentucky to target the senator's constituents directly on the issue. The $38 billion deal is the most generous ever to Israel. The act, awaiting the Senate vote, also expands a stockpile of weapons that the U.S. has maintained in Israel since the first U.S. war in Iraq, to which Israel has access in wartime and has resorted to in its wars on Gaza. The stockpile was seen at the time as an attempt by President George H.W. Bush to mollify the Israelis by keeping them from joining the war in Iraq after a Scud missile landed in Israel. The currently blocked act also reportedly enhances Israel's qualitative military edge over all of its adversaries in the region, real and imagined, which is required by U.S. law, and urges space research cooperation between Israel and the United States. No doubt a way will be found to change Senator Paul's mind, as occurred the last time he sought to block an arms package for Israel. Pro-Israel Jewish organizations worldwide are even more concerned by a decision by Airbnb not to list rentals in the occupied West Bank. Last Thursday, lawyers launched a class action lawsuit in Israel against a San Francisco-based company, accusing it of, quote, outrageous discrimination, quote, and demanding monetary damages after it withdrew listings in the illegal Jewish settlements. Airbnb said it was removing listings of around 200 homes in settlements after hearing criticism from people who, quote, believe companies should not profit on lands where people have been displaced, end quote. Exemplifying the meaning of chutzpah, speaking to her attorneys, Manit Rabinovich from the West Bank settlement of Kedah, who offers guest room rentals, said the move, quote, represents especially grave, offensive, and outrageous discrimination, end quote. The company's decision, affirmed her lawyers, is in effect directed solely against Israeli citizens living in the settlements, the petitioner claims, and this is severe, especially outrageous discrimination, part of the long war being conducted by organizations of which a clear majority are anti-Semitic, against the State of Israel in its entirety, and against Israelis living in settlements in particular, end quote. The Palestinian Arabs are not allowed to live or rent in the exclusively Jewish areas in the West Bank, as does not apparently, in their eyes, amount to discrimination, not outrageous or even mildly so. Israeli officials, as could be expected, reacted with anger to Airbnb's announcement, viewing it as a concession to and a significant symbolic victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at pressuring Israel on its treatment of Palestinians in the manner of a similar movement that targeted Israel's one-time ally, apartheid South Africa. Israeli tourism minister Yariv Levin said the, quote, miserable decision was shameful. A disgraceful surrender by the company and ordered his office to develop measures to hinder Airbnb's activity in the country and put together a plan designed to encourage tourism in West Bank settlements. Flying in the face of fact and world opinion, Gilad Erdan, the Israeli government's point person for fighting the boycott movement, said in a radio interview that, quote, there is no distinction between this part or that part of the State of Israel, unquote. He compared his ministry's efforts to that of the Israeli army that continuously attacks terrorist organizations even though there are occasional attacks, unquote. He called on property owners to sue Airbnb, using Israel's law for prevention of damage to the State of Israel through boycott. Well, last Wednesday, representatives from Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the country's ministries of tourism, foreign affairs, justice, economy, and Israel's tax authority met in Jerusalem to discuss ways to overturn the company's decision, while Israeli Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Zippy Hatovli sent a letter to Airbnb protesting the move. Airbnb's announcement did not come out of the blue. The day before, New York-based Human Rights Watch was set to publish a report outlining the company's activities in Israeli settlements. Titled Bed and Breakfast on Stolen Land, the report provides information about 139 properties that Airbnb listed in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem, in the spring of 2018. In a statement emailed to Reuters last Tuesday, Chris Lahan, Airbnb's global head of policy and communication, said, quote, Israel is a special place, and our over 22,000 hosts are special people who have welcomed hundreds of thousands of guests to Israel. We understand that this is a hard and complicated issue, and we appreciate everyone's perspective, end quote. From the Israeli perspective, the feeling is definitely not mutual. They are well aware that should Airbnb get away with delisting rentals in the West Bank, it would be the greatest victory yet for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and set a dangerous precedent that other companies may choose to follow. A bemused opinion writer for Haaretz, David Rosenberg, noted that, quote, it won't even scratch the Israeli economy or even that of the settlements, but it did drive the government into hysterics, end quote. Joining in those hysterics, I expect, if Airbnb does not back down, will be members of Congress of both parties used to kissing Israel's behind, demanding penalties on the rental service for having done the right thing. If nothing else, the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi at the hands of the Saudi government may end up bringing an end to the U.S. support for Saudi's war in Yemen and prevented a combined U.S.-Saudi-Israeli war on Iran, since making war is something that has come naturally to this country since its inception. I've been thinking a lot about that since reading a moving essay in the November 26th issue of Time by Vietnamese-American writer Viet Tran Nguyen, titled American Like Me, What It Feels to Love My Country No Matter How It Feels About Me, a brief section of which I have chosen to share with you. Speaking of the war in the land of his birth that would lead his parents to seek refuge in the U.S., he writes, quote, many Americans consider the war to be a noble, if possibly flawed, example of American good intentions. And while there is some truth to that, it was also simply a continuation of French colonization, a war that was racist and imperialist at its root and in its practices. As such, this war was just one manifestation of a centuries-long expansion of the American empire that began from its own colonial birth and ran through the frontier, the American West, Mexico, Hawaii, Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and now the Middle East. One war might be a mistake, he writes. A long series of wars is a pattern. Indians were the original terrorists in the American imagination. The genocide committed against them by white settlers is Thanksgiving's ugly side, he writes, not quite remembered, but not really forgotten. Even in France, where images of a half-naked Native American in a feathered headdress can also be found. Centuries later, writes Viet Tran Nguyen, the latent memory of genocide or the celebration of conquest would surface when American GIs called hostile Vietnamese territory Indian country. Now Muslims are the new gooks, while terrorists are the new communists, since communists are no longer very threatening, and every society needs an other to define its boundaries and funnel its fears. Many Americans do not like to hear these things, he acknowledges. An American veteran of the war, an enlisted man, wrote me in rage after reading an essay of mine on the scars that Vietnamese refugees carried. Americans had sacrificed themselves for my country, my family, me, he said. I should be grateful. Another Vietnam vet, a former officer, now a doctor and dentist, more calmly, after beginning his autobiographical novel, The Sympathizer, but apparently not finishing it, suggested that if he liked the communists so much, he should go back to Vietnam and take his son with him. I was worried and did not write back to him, writes Tran Nguyen. I should have. I would have pointed out that he must not have finished my novel since the last quarter indicts communism's failure in Vietnam. Tran Nguyen reveals in his essay is something rare among Americans who have not traveled much nor had the experience of living in a foreign country and witnessed the impact that U.S. policies had on that country, for U.S. policies increasingly impact every country. It goes a long way in explaining the lack of understanding on the part of most Americans to the worldwide refugee crisis, of which U.S. wars and interventions have been the primary cause. This is the problem at the highest levels, as revealed in an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, co-authored by former Obama National Security Advisors Ben Rose and Jake Sullivan, entitled Fixing America's Image. And they said that Trump's Democrats should challenge the president on his approach to the forever war when it was something that he inherited from the Trump administration. There's another challenge looming on the horizon. It is the fate of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, holed up since 2012 in Ecuador's London embassy, who prior to the 2016 elections released some emails that exposed the duplicity of Hillary Clinton and those in the Democratic National Committee who are making sure she received the Democratic Party presidential nomination and not Bernie Sanders. Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, has withdrawn the credentials of his UK ambassador, who has been at the center of negotiating the fate of the WikiLeaks co-founder, raising concerns for his safety. The decree with which Moreno effectively sacked Ecuador's London ambassador Abad Ortiz offered no explanation as to why Ortiz, who had been his country's ambassador to the UK since 2015, had been permanently recalled, nor did it name his successor. Abad, appointed to the office under President Rafael Correa, was the last diplomat Assange knew in the embassy. All diplomats known to Assange have now been transferred away from the embassy, the WikiLeaks site claimed. The sudden change in Assange's situation has led to the belief among his supporters that Moreno is doing Washington's bidding by removing people who might have stood by Assange and opposed his potential handover to the British police, which is expected to bring about a swift extradition to the U.S. His supporters are calling the new situation a, quote, a silent pro-U.S. coup. Should Assange, who arguably has done more to expose ugly truths about U.S. and foreign and domestic policies and that of other countries than anyone in my lifetime, be brought to the United States to stand trial for having revealed U.S. state secrets, as now seems likely, it will be a moment of truth for those who genuinely believe in a free media. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.